Saturday, 14th June, 1975. I think it would be worth our while this afternoon to consider a very serious topic. When we experience a spell of bright sunny weather in these latitudes, we all feel very happy and cheerful, bubbling over with vitality and so on, unless of course it proves rather too hot for us. But whilst we may feel like that, we must also bear in mind that there are those throughout the world, and there are many, many millions, hundreds of millions of them, who are suffering a very great deal. Suffering from wars, from deprivation, famine, disease, suffering still worse from the consequences of greed and violence and pathetic stupidity. I mention this because we all tend to be so self-oriented. If we are truly concerned with the religious life, if we are truly concerned with being growing into our pure humanity, then we really must wake up. We must be mindful of this self-orientedness. Look carefully. Be very watchful and see how in all our actions, our words, our thoughts and feelings, and particularly in our desires and our planning, we are all the time self-concerned. The best amongst us, like anybody else in the world. This is a very serious fact. And this self-concern enters like a poisoned barb into the field of that which we hold most dear, most worthwhile. We class that under the term religion. God, Nirvana, the kingdom of heaven, perfection, and all the rest of it. Lovely words. They stir us. But they stir us self-concernedly. We would like to have it. Let us have no illusions about this. We are grasping after something which is agreeable to ourselves. So deep-rooted this is that the mind refuses to face the fact, the reality of our existence. I use the term the one total reality. Some of us, maybe all of us, are willing to swallow that phrase. May be willing to use it in preference to other words which have been used through the ages. But have we ever understood some of the simplest consequences, one of the simplest, let me say, implications wrapped up in that term, the one total reality? First of all, consider it is a one total reality in which all the multitudinous finite particulars are integral part and parcel. The one whole becomes the innumerable many. The innumerable many, because of their complete and total relationship with each other and within the whole, constitute the one whole. The innumerable many are not separate, unchanging, perpetually identifiable entities through all time. Life is action, activity. And in this universal interaction, there is continual change. There is continual appearance, momentarily or for a period of time, and then the disappearance of that particular entity. The absolute and total disappearance of entity. But since the one total reality contains everything, there is no annihilation of any entity, but complete transformation of entity, which means that it has ceased to be identifiable as that entity forever and ever in the process of transformation. Do you get this? Because this is fundamentally important for all mankind, really. It's a terrible thing to see truth. Entity as such absolutely disappears, which means there is no such thing as survival of personality, amongst other things. Therefore, this particular entity sitting here talking to you, bearing the name that he bears, when this particular entity dies, as we say, the disintegration is total and complete. The solids, liquids, gases, the energies, the thoughts, feelings, perceptions, character, the consciousness are all completely disintegrated. As Shakespeare put in The Tempest, when Ariel speaks, "Full fathom five thy father lies," etc. Of him nothing doth remain, but suffers a sea change into something rich and strange, which means that thy father, who lies full fathom five, as father, has absolutely disappeared. I think that was Shakespeare's way of saying something which he dare not say in direct form, because the church would probably have made him uncomfortable for such a heresy. There is no such thing as heaven or hell or a hereafter once this entity disrupts, altogether disrupts. Therefore, there is no such thing as a goal for me. I want you to get hold of this point. That is to say, not believe it. That's useless. Because you'll merely react against the belief if you can't enter into the deeps of your own heart and mind and see truth. You'll merely react against it. You'll merely get neurotic. You'll merely suffer. Not that most of us are not neurotic in some way or other already, but still. You see? Really try. Do try and understand this. If I didn't care for you, I would not say these things to you. They are too terrible to say. There is nothing for me. Get that. Really understand it. When one really understands, all self-seeking completely vanishes. And my God, then you are in heaven. Then you know what it is to be in bliss. When all self-seeking vanishes. So many things that we grasp, that we struggle for, which are the sources of our anxiety and misery, of all our wickedness and cruelty and oppression, and our accursed stupidity, all those just vanish. You cease to do evil. What did the Buddha say? Cease to do evil. Strive to do good. Purify the mind. That is the way of the Buddhas. Now, this is the first and the most important thing to understand, that there is absolutely nothing for me, the person. Whatsoever happens through me, comes to me, goes out of me, is part of a universal becoming process. My supreme delusion is that there is something, there is an I, an entity which does not change, which is immortal. And all sorts of stupid theological doctrines have been invented. The immortal soul or the spark of God and so forth and so forth. Poor old God having to sustain innumerable countless millions of sparks. You see, we invent these doctrines. Why? To bolster up our selfness. Our selfness born of ignorance. That is why one can only be compassionate. I have used strong language today, I think, as I've rarely used in our meetings in these 13 odd years. But we are a stupid lot. The best amongst us. Subconsciously, unconsciously, we work towards a goal. We even had the conceit to superimpose a goal upon the transcendent, upon the unborn, the unmade, the unbecome, upon God, upon Brahman, or the Atma, or whatever it is. We superimpose it and say, it is all in order that this wonderful purpose may come to fruition, and we shall be happy afterwards in blessed fellowship and all sorts of stuff and nonsense. Nihilistic? No. This is not nihilistic. This is clear-sighted vision of the fact, the one total reality. Take your bread knife and start cutting up the one total reality and see how far you go. It still remains the one total reality. You can't add to it, you can't subtract from it. You can't multiply it, you can't divide it. And it is precisely because we do all these things, that is to say, we try to do these things, that we are sinners. That's the great meaning of the word sin, to try to divide the unity, to sunder the unity, to hurt the unity, to spoil the unity. And the unity is the infinity, the immeasurable, non-finite, non-being. Don't you see how simple the whole thing is, really? And if you once just see this, everything falls into order. You know why? Because I have ceased to be in disorder, a disorder which was born of and is maintained and nurtured and perpetuated by the I am I misconcept. Empirically, when we are talking with each other, we say, oh, I am John Smith or Mary Brown or whoever it is. Within the limited context of the changing, becoming process, one may use these terms, but only within that limited context. But unfortunately, the 4,000 millions of the world are ignorant, and they think of it not as a limited context, but as a permanent context, as the total context. For instance, even in Buddhism, and I say even in Buddhism because the Buddha's psychological analysis is the most drastic of all the great religious analyses of what the person with whom you see before you is composed of. Even there, people will quote the Buddha in this fashion. The Buddha says, in one of the discourses, but because there is a beyond, I affirm so and so, so and so, so and so. He said, people falsely accuse me of saying that there is no beyond. All right. The Buddha did say those words. I'm sure he said those words. But when I read them first, when you read them first, when you read them now, do you know what he meant by there is a beyond? What was the Buddha concerned with? The continuation of a particular entity called a person? Not the least bit. Was he concerned with the prevailing political systems in the kingdoms of India in those days? Not a bit. With the economic disorders or troubles or difficulties or prosperities? Not the least bit. With the educational system, with the social order? Not at all. Was he concerned with the people who were sick and perishing of all kinds of diseases and so forth? Not at all. What was he concerned with? He was concerned with the mind of the individual. He, like all the other great teachers, was the healer of the mind. That means the one who so dealt with himself in the first instance, that's how he became the Buddha, the enlightened one, and who could so deal with others that he could help them to emerge out of the fragmented state of the mind into the whole, the holy, unfragmented, total mind. And when you emerge that way into the total mind, it is not your total mind at all, because totality has no meaning if it is restricted to an individual. That is what he was concerned with, the release of the mind, unconditioned freedom of mind. That is the fruit of living the holy life, the religious life. He says that categorically, again and again. That is what he was concerned with. So now, this is the beyond. The release from all our limitations, all our imprisoned state, our state of being debtors, the release from that into the freedom of the unconditioned state. The unconditioned meaning the state which represents order, not disorder. The whole, not the fragmented state. The one, the state in which you as a person are no longer liable to delusion. This is what he was concerned with. He was not concerned with giving you a certificate or a prize on speech day. Now, friend, you get nirvana straight away, you're amongst the top 10. You get the once returner state because you're among the next 10. And you are amongst the 7 times returner state because you're amongst the third lot of 10s. Not all that nonsense, but this is precisely how it is interpreted by us. There is a beyond. And if you look carefully into your minds, really look with a searchlight that will completely burn up the dross of one's own foolishness and stupidity. If you really look into your own minds, you will find that lurking underneath it all is that demon Mephistopheles, laughing away how successfully I've deluded this holy man. That is to say, the man who's trying to be holy. You know, see this, and there will be laughter in your hearts, silent laughter, the laughter of the gods. I use that phrase, laughter of the gods, not just as a poetic expression. What is the laughter of the gods? It is the happiness which characterizes all the archetypal energies as they work harmoniously throughout the cosmos. This is the laughter of the gods. And this perhaps may be one meaning of that inscrutable smile on the face of the Buddha, in the images. That smile. He did not promise you nirvana. I know you can easily quote, I can quote it against myself, his very first words after the enlightenment to the bhikkhus were, hearken bhikkhus, the deathless has been found. Alright, the deathless has been found. But is deathlessness my mental construct, which interprets it as wonderful pleasure, no more figures printed in red in my bank account, and so on and so on, no more anxieties, no troubles with wife or child or husband or business associate or or trade unions or whatever they may be. Not a bit of it. Nothing to do with that. What is this deathlessness? It's a mode of functioning which is manifest through the particular individual who has realized unconditioned freedom of mind. It's a mode of functioning. Nirvana is not your prize at all. It is a manifestation of the one total reality having come to fruition through you, because you have given yourself to it in the right way. Given yourself to that one total reality and are thrilling and living in tune with it. Therefore you shine like the sun shines. And you radiate love and beauty and truth and goodness and wisdom and any other word which expresses the supreme beatitudes that we know of. Look, do get this. How many of us are here today? Michael? About?
18.
20. We are 20 here today. If we 20 really understand this, our minds, our whole mode of awareness of existence is utterly transformed. Through us then radiate energies which transform others. We don't have to plan and desire to do that. All evangelism is just immature folly. It's just the work of adolescence, not the work of wisdom. We don't have to do that. The very fact that we are like that means that through us radiates all this energy. And this energy, which emerges out of that marvelous order which lies at the heart of the transcendent real, works flawlessly. Whereas if I start planning, I will invariably make mistakes. Then you will realize in your own lifetime the meaning of those words in Genesis, be fruitful and multiply. Just exactly how has the world misapplied those wonderful words? It has become overfruitful and multiplied to the point of destruction. Is multiplying to the point of, dangerously to the point of destruction. Not that multiplication. Not procreation. But true creation can come out of men and women. Man. How often have we talked about this? The meaning of the word man. The creator. Man, manyate. That minding which is creative power, creative energy in action. That is the meaning of minding. The activity of creative power brings into being. That is creation. And it is always new. It is never repetitive. It doesn't have a prototype, a blueprint which it follows. Where there is a blueprint which finds its repetition again and again, like you or I will produce human beings, the monkeys will produce monkeys, and mosquitoes will produce mosquitoes, and oak trees will produce oak trees, and so forth, you see, all true to type. That is procreation. This is not the unconditioned state. Just as an aside, if one really understands this, one will naturally be a celibate. There are no problems. if one understands it. But if you understand this, you need not sit here and listen to me talking. So you see, creation, man, now it all has its roots in waking up, really waking up to the significance of the fact that the universe is a one total reality. If you really wake up to that and let the vision of that meaning, which will transcend all thoughts and words which may come up in your brain, that vision will utterly purify the mind of selfness, of self-orientedness. If you find yourself thinking, feeling, reacting, working in terms of selfness, drawing the world unto yourself, then be sure that you have not yet really understood the significance. That's what it means. Because when there is complete understanding, there is transmutation. You are changed forever. You can't do the wrong thing anymore. You can only do the perfect thing, because it has become the natural thing for you, the living being. That is why you don't have to struggle to do it. When you and I were born, we couldn't walk, still less run. Gradually, through practice, through work, the discipline of everyday life, we became able to walk and to run. And it becomes second nature. You don't have to struggle to walk. You just walk. It's like that. This is real growth. That is to say, it is a process of flowering out in tune with the trend of life itself. And life is omnipotent. And life, the term life includes everything. Otherwise, the Chandogya Upanishad would not have said Brahman is Brahmana, prana, life. It's not biological life merely. It's not breath merely. It is the whole thing. There's no such thing as dead matter anywhere. No such thing. No energy is a dead thing. No force. No, nothing that our senses can touch. And nothing which comes to our brains and our minds through the avenues of the senses is dead. Everything is alive. The total universe is a living universe. Therefore, Brahman is prana. Brahman is the void, the infinite, the not limited. And Brahman is bliss. The three statements are there in the Chandogya Upanishad. Just like that. And they are all put together. Brahman is prana, ka, kang. What's the good of reading these things and saying, oh, how wonderfully these old people saw into things and so forth. They don't need approbation from conceited little fellows like myself. Intellectuals who merely read these things and write tomes out of our abysmal ignorance. They don't need that at all. God is not in need of any praise. He knows what He is countless million times better than what I can say of Him. If I sing a hymn of praise, it is because my heart overflows out of love, out of complete self-surrender. When that happens because I am not, then indeed God smiles. What are the things that we search for in life? In the ordinary way. Remember, we are animals. We seek for food to perpetuate the self. We seek sex to perpetuate the species. These are the two fundamental animal drives. And when, because of the veneer, this very superficial, very thin veneer of culture, which our race and our history hands down to us, we think that we have sort of grown into a deeper, wonderful life. All we have done is to gild, to clothe in nice clean garments that which is not so clean within those garments. We really must see that. Don't see it self-deprecatorily. That's no use. It's no use castigating the self. It's no use damning the self. Because you see, from within our own self, the riposte will come back at us. And 10 days later we'll say, oh, what a fool I was to say that of myself. What was the truth then? See truth objectively. Try to see it objectively. Unselfedly. And then everything will reveal itself to you. The speck of dust, the thing which you see when the sunlight is shining through the window, and you see these lovely little glittering specks of dust, you see, they will tell you God's own truth. When a donkey brays, he is telling you God's own truth. When the stars shine, when the rain falls, when you fall into a heap of muck by accident, you can learn God's own truth. If one sees that, one ceases to rail against life, to start with. And on the practical side, one ceases, completely ceases, to try to change things into the likeness of what we would like, into the shape we want. Don't do that. Leave the universe alone. And if you leave the universe alone, the universe will cradle you with infinite motherly love. I know this is a very serious problem. We all, I myself, through our lives, time and again, we suffer from this feeling, we are not wanted, we are not loved, we are not cared for, we are always kicked. But you see, there is that in our particular web of destiny which holds that in store. Then of course the person rises up and says, but what have I done to deserve it? I have done nothing to deserve it. The universal process does very funny things. Funny, peculiar. funny, terrible things. There is no special sense in asking, what have I done to deserve? By all means, try and see what I have done which has contributed to the painful, the awful, the hurtful, and so forth. Yes. But don't think in terms of deserving, because if I don't agree with the judge's decree, I will say he's a bad judge. Don't ask that question, therefore. But try and see, this pattern is in my web of destiny. In some way, I draw this to me. If the fact is that I have not contributed towards it, then there is some divine purpose working itself out by handing over this bitter situation to me. And if I learn something out of it, which is really most worthwhile learning, and undergo the purification of my own mind and heart, then this person who has done it becomes an even more powerful center from which radiates transcendent energy. And this is how the ways of life are fulfilled through the individual and through individual suffering. Don't discard suffering. Of course, those who are deeply concerned with the Buddha's teaching say, but the Buddha said that his whole purpose was to get rid of suffering. What did he mean by suffering? He didn't mean what we mean, that I'm suffering from lack of money, that my girlfriend or my boyfriend has jilted me, that this, that and the other worldly thing has happened. He didn't mean that at all. You look at the word dukkha. Du, that which is bad, made bad, spoiled. Secondary meanings, fundamental meaning, far from, that's the du part, Ka, and Ka is the infinite, the transcendent. This is suffering. Does it need a perfected holy one to solve the ordinary worldly sufferings? We take it in our stride. Mankind at large, by and large, more or less takes all the difficulties that come in its stride. We have to. We have to deal with our problems, and we do deal with them. We don't need enlightened ones or sons of God or Brahmaputras or any such person to tell us about it. And they never did tell us anything about it, because our problems are political, economic, social, and wrapped up in all our foolishness. Far from the transcendent distorted, the unconditioned twisted, the mind stupid, ignorant. This was the dukkha. You see? And it is this suffering, because of the enlightenment, was the suffering which could be transformed. And when it is transformed, because the mind itself is liberated, then that person manifests the reality of nirvana. And you know the first meaning of nirvana? Blown out, extinguished. What is extinguished? And the Buddha unequivocally declared the extinction of greed, hate, delusion. The extinction of greed, hate, and delusion has nothing to do with pleasure. Nothing to do with what we think is the good thing. Now, you can, if you like, relate that, because I use the word the good, because I use the term the good thing, the meaning of goodness. We don't know the meaning of goodness. So, I'm referring you to the words of Jesus, when that man came and said, "Good master, what shall I do to gain eternal life? Why callest thou me good? There is none good. There is only one that is good, and that is God, the transcendent, the infinite, the sukha." Su means happy, orderly, perfect. The happy infinite, the happy transcendent. And you and I can't define that. And you see, what happens to all your anxieties and conflicts? If you really understand this, the one total reality, and out with the self-centeredness, conflict disappears. The conflict which spoils us, causes us, makes us ill in mind, that is what disappears. Doesn't mean pleasure will come. Pleasure and pain will just come and go like that, you see. Like the English weather. Sunshine and rain and cold and heat, and like any other weather. Very mutable. Very unreliable. Place not thy trust in princes, whether they be princes who control the winds and the waters, or whether they be princes of another sort. But do consider this. Do consider it very, very carefully. There is no solution to world problems, to national problems, and so forth. All our plunging into all kinds of activities for this good and that good are escapes from our fundamental business. I'm using the word business in the grand sense of the term. Our fundamental business is to purify the mind and the heart. And on that foundation, world order will arise.